Hello and welcome to the first podcast of 2021. We're all delighted to be back with you with a whole new year to look forward to, hunting down forgotten books and writers. For now, we are still recording these podcasts remotely, so perched in front of their respective laptops, we have Slightly Foxed editor Hazel Wood.
Hello.
Hello, Hazel. Her fellow editor Gail Perkins should be there too. Gail?
I'm here, and it's very nice to hear everybody. Nice to be back.
Isn't it? And fellow Fox Stephanie Allen.
Hello, and happy 2021.
My name is Philippa Lamb. I need to admit, right now, we've just moved house into what is effectively a building site with very dodgy broadband, so please forgive any banging in the background, and if I disappear completely, Gail assures me that she will take over. We have a particularly interesting discussion for you this time. It's new territory for the podcast. Before we make a start, though, Steph, you have got, I think, another suggestion for a book lover's day trip.
Yes, today it's Petersfield, which is a small market town on the edge of the Hampshire-West Sussex border, where we have lots of Slightly Foxed ties and three bookshops.
Excellent. We'll hear about that later. For now, though, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you'll know we usually bring you discussions about books that have been lost or generally forgotten. Today, we are doing something rather different. We're going to talk about people who've been lost and who might well have been forgotten, were it not for a remarkable man who established a library all about them. Dr. Alfred Wiener and his Holocaust Library. We have a guest here to tell us all about Dr. Wiener. Gail has known him for many years. He's a regular contributor to Slightly Foxed. So I'm going to hand over to Gail to introduce him.
Thanks, Philippa. Well, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Anthony Wells, who spent a decade working at London's Wiener Library in the 80s. Tony, thank you so much for being with us. The Wiener Library is an archive, well, it's the world's oldest institution, isn't it, devoted to the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about how it came to be founded?
Well, Wiener was born in the end of the 19th century in Potsdam to a Jewish family. He was a very patriotic German. He studied Oriental languages, actually, but then served in the First World War. He got Iron Cross Second Class, I believe. And then he got a position within the main organisation representative body of Jews in Germany. It was sort of equivalent to the British Board of Deputies. After the war, he became very active in combating the rise of an anti-Semitism, which, while it had been there in German life before the war, became much more pronounced after it, with what was called the stab in the back legend.
Because many people blamed Germany's defeat on a Jewish conspiracy.
Well, Jewish socialist, yes. That in fact, I mean, the myth arose on the right, and particularly amongst the far right, that Germany had never actually been militarily defeated, that it was because of betrayal at home that German armed forces had lost the war. And then, of course, they protested. They were very put out by the terms of the Versailles Treaty, which were regarded not just by the far right as humiliating.
Tony, am I right in thinking he was one of the very first people to actually noted the rise of the Nazi Party?
Yes, he started putting out. His aim was to combat the very irrational appeals of the anti-Semites by arguing more rationally about the benefits, the Jewish contribution to German life, which of course was enormous, doing his best to put the case for Jewish life in Germany as against this rabble-rousing propaganda from the Nazi Party and others. He became particularly interested in combating the Nazi Party as soon as Hitler was released from the prison he incarcerated in after his failed putsch in 1923. Hitler was released in 24, and from 24 onwards, the Nazi Party began to gather increasing support in Germany. And that was when Wiener and his organisation became much more focused on combating Hitler and the Nazis, yes.
So in doing this, he amassed an enormous range of material from that period.
Yes, he did. There was a sort of sister organisation whose purpose was to collect as much material as possible, as well as putting out information to combat Nazi propaganda. having had one or two interviews, the penny dropped very, very fast that there would be no role for him in Nazi Germany after April 1933. And so he left with his family for Amsterdam. And that was where he really began. As soon as he had set up his office, he began to collect as much as he could on all aspects of the Nazi movement and its history.
How did he do that at a distance, really?
At that time, there were plenty of connections still between Holland and Germany, and also a lot of German publications would be readily available in Holland, not just the major Nazi newspaper, but other stuff, including the anti-Semitic Stürmer. And so I don't think the difficulty came after the office removed to London in 39, because, of course, from September 39, which was when the Jewish Central Information Office opened its doors in London, from that moment, you couldn't get hold of Nazi material. And in fact, Wiener spent most of the war years in New York because it was so much easier to get hold of Nazi material.
Before America entered the war.
Yes, exactly. And pretty quickly, because the British government discovered in September 39, directly afterwards, it really didn't know very much about the background of the Nazi regime, the history, the biographies of its leaders, and even its thinking in areas apart from the political area. So Wiener's material was a sort of treasure trove for various departments of the British government. First and foremost, I think it was used for something called the Department of Economic Warfare or something like that. It was basically a propaganda department within the British government for which Wiener supplied a lot of background material to inform what they broadcast and what they produced in the way of leaflets and things to be dropped in Germany and so on. But it was used also just for research purposes by various sections of the government and the BBC.
So, Tony, actually during the war years, he was gathering material that was published. Were people smuggling this sort of stuff out of Germany at the time? Or how did he actually get his hands on it?
Well, obviously he had quite a lot. I mean, I think everything that they had in Amsterdam was brought over. So that was already here. And then he was in America from about May 1940. And there until December 41, he could still get hold of stuff. And I think after 41, probably via South America, I don't think much was coming. I mean, people were getting out from Vichy France and places like that, but I'm not sure anyone could really bring very much material with them.
So was he also collecting eyewitness accounts?
Yes.
The eyewitness accounts, yes, insofar as people did get out, they would talk to them. At the end of the war, 1945, the library set up what they call an eyewitness account program, where people who'd survived and who either had arrived in the UK or were in the DP camps in occupied Germany, Wiener had a team of people who went out and interviewed them and took down very detailed notes of what they said, translated it from German, if German was the language being used, or Polish or whatever. And these documents provided some of the first accounts of what had gone on, including the few people who'd survived the extermination camps and the concentration camps.
It's because it's extraordinary, isn't it? One sort of forgets that, I mean, I know a little of what was going on was known in the West, but the revelations after the war, well, I mean, there are so many people who describe how they reacted to the film of Belsen being liberated, yeah. For example. I mean, it was an enormous shock, wasn't it?
Yes, I mean, reports have been coming out. I noticed that the JCIO, the Jewish Central Information Office, actually publicised a report that had appeared in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency in 1942 about Auschwitz. So there were reports trickling out, but certainly nobody had realised until. And in fact, Wiener's own family were in Belsen, and his wife and daughters got out of Belsen. His wife sadly died very soon after they got to Switzerland. But his daughter survived, and in fact, one of them is the mother of Daniel Finkelstein.
The Times correspondent.
Yeah, now Lord Finkelstein, in fact, who I once bumped into in the cavernous basement of the Wiener Library when I first started there.
So was some Wiener during the war, was he in fact trying to draw attention to what he knew of the Presumably he must have known something about the camps. To the government?
Yes. Well, they put out something called The Nazis at War, which was their publication during the war. And any information that he was getting was publicised that way.
But presumably this material, Tony, played into the Nuremberg trials after the war.
Definitely. It? The eyewitness accounts, obviously. And in fact, one of the chief prosecutors at the trials said that what Wiener had provided and his institute had provided was absolutely invaluable to the prosecution case. And one went so far as to say that the trials could hardly have taken place without the material that Wiener had provided.
Mm. You know, in preparation for this podcast, Tony, I was reading a bit about the Nuremberg trials, because if I'm honest, I didn't actually know that much about them. And I had not understood that it was President Truman we have to thank for those, really, because Churchill and others, including Stalin, were favouring a much more abrupt solution of just summary executions.
Oh, that's very interesting. I had always assumed it was part of the Allied war aims that they published in 43 or 44 or something.
But it made me realise how important Wiener's material must have been to that, because actually it wouldn't have had, you know, there wouldn't have been an opportunity to hear these accounts and see these publications.
No, and the Nuremberg documents became, as they were known, some of them were published, others remained unpublished. There were huge, huge numbers of them at the library when I was there, which were used all the time by researchers.
The other thing I learned about Nuremberg trials was, what I believe to be true, is that it was the first time that the word genocide was actually used.
Yes, the word genocide was coined just around that time, yes. But it's the 75th anniversary, I think, and there's a book just been published by Philippe Sands, and there's a film about the Nuremberg trials made by the niece of an old colleague of mine from the Wiener Library, who sadly died earlier this year, and I hadn't known. She was actually at Nuremberg as a translator.
Wow.
And then it set up as an independent library after the end of the war, and it was certainly recognised by historians as being of absolutely crucial importance. That wasn't necessarily because historians don't normally have very deep pockets, so getting it, assuring its survival was a quite different matter, but in terms of its value to the study of Nazi Germany, the history of anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, all of those subjects, and indeed totalitarianism more generally, it was very quickly recognised as being the most valuable resource in the world.
Mm-hmm. Very extraordinary experience, really, working at the library, because I gather that quite a lot of people go there in order to sort of trace what's happened to their families and so on.
Yes. More so now than then. When I was there, there was still a lot of research being done into Nazi Germany, the Holocaust, establishing exactly what happened, who had been responsible. There was a book by a man called Christopher Browning called Ordinary Men, I think it was, about recruits from police forces in Germany who took part in the mass shooting of Jews and others in occupied Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. But the family history, yes, latterly, that has become a strong focus of the library's work now. They recently were given a copy of something called the International Tracing Service documents, a digital copy. That's 17.5 million documents, apparently. Originally, the International Tracing Service based in Arlesen in Germany, but it was set up on the initiative of the British Red Cross to try to establish who the people who were still alive, where they'd come from, to record their names, and then through them to try to record the names of the people who had vanished, you know, disappeared.
Yes, I also read that after Brexit, they're helping people to establish their German connections, as it were, in order to get, German.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And the collection includes books from people who went through the Holocaust, not just about the Holocaust, doesn't it? Actually, people who survived it, contributed to it.
Yes,
what sort of things, Tony? Some of those must have an amazing history attached to them.
Yes. Well, one of the things I remember most vividly, there is an account called An Englishman in Auschwitz. It was a man called Leon Greenman who would come into the library every so often and who happily lived to a ripe old age, died not long ago in his 90s. He was in Holland. He was half Dutch, half British, but had British papers, as did his wife. He had a little boy called Barney. Unfortunately, He lost his British papers. Had he had British papers, he would have been interned. But instead of which, he couldn't prove his British nationality, and they were taken from Westerbork, which was a sort of transit camp in Holland, straight to Auschwitz. His wife and son were murdered immediately. He survived, partly because he was extremely physically strong, partly because he had various talents which were extremely useful. One, he was a hairdresser, and two, he had a very good voice. He'd sung in the synagogue. And a combination of these things, and luck, of course, without which he had no chance of surviving. And he would come into the library once or twice a year, partly because he deposited his camp uniform there. I mean, although the library was mainly books and pamphlets, there were objects there as well, including his uniform from a camp called Buchenwald in Germany itself, where he ended up.
So there are objects as well?
There are objects, yes, one of which you might have seen on a, it was called a Holocaust Memorial, I think, Antiques Roadshow.
Oh, gosh.
It was an anti-Semitic board game called in German Juden raus, which is Jews out. It was a board game where the object was to, it was a walled sort of medieval German town, and I think you shook dice and you collected Jews and deposited them outside the walls.
So this was for children, Tony? A game
yes,
for children.
This was for children. And there are some equally evil children's textbooks, which the library has an extraordinary collection of as well. Yeah.
It's a very sophisticated propaganda machine.
Yes. It's quite extraordinary when you think, you know, that what Hitler referred to as the thousand-year Reich lasted for 12 years. 6 years were in peacetime, but the extent to which the Nazis took control of every possible area of German life is quite extraordinary. And that is reflected in the textbooks that were produced, not just anti-Semitic textbooks, but also racial theory, what they called Rassenhygiene, racial hygiene. If you were an Aryan, inverted commas, you had to breed with other Aryans and so forth.
And of course, the ruthless documentation of all of this played into the downfall at the end, didn't it? The Nuremberg trials, that everything that was done was documented and ended
Absolutely.
Up in places like the Wiener Library.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
The focus of the library is sort of wider now, isn't it?
It certainly broadened out. It always covered not just the Jewish catastrophe, but also the gypsies. The first books on what happened to the gypsies under Nazi occupation were written from the Wiener Library. More recently, yes, the library now has links to something called Waging Peace, I think. It's an NGO. And they have a particular collection on Darfur. And the library has linked up with them now, so that they have an archive on Darfur.
Yes, I saw there was an exhibition of children's drawings or paintings.
Yes.
From Darfur, yes.
They're very striking, aren't they? The library is open to the public. It has an exhibition room. It has regular exhibitions. It's in Russell Square nowadays in central London.
And am I right in thinking you can do guided tours, Tony?
They do a guided tour, yes, when we're not in lockdown.
No, but under normal times.
Yes, and talks and all kinds of things go on at the library, don't they? And travelling exhibitions. And
very much so.
Has anybody actually written a biography of Wiener?
No, but there is a history of the library, which is written by its most recent director, now recently retired, which does give the outline of Wiener's life.
Mm. This sounds like a job for you, Tony, doesn't it?
It's been done.
It is an extraordinary story. I mean, what happened to Dr. Wiener after the war? What was his story after all this?
Well, he ran his library. He continued to collect. He tried desperately to get secure funding for it with big success. And he eventually died in 1963, I think. He visited Germany, gave talks in Germany.
It's an extraordinary journey from Iron Cross in the First War to that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, his life embodies the story of German Jewry very much, because the German Jews were amongst the most assimilated. Many loyal German Jews fought in the First World War on the German side, obviously. And so what happened afterwards, the end of the Weimar Republic and the rise of Hitler, was bitter disillusionment for them.
And I suppose explains why so many didn't get out sooner or didn't manage to get out at all, because it seemed scarcely credible what was happening.
Absolutely.
Well, publishing in England was completely changed, really, wasn't it, by the arrival of people like Weidenfeld and Walter Neurath at Thames and Hudson and André Deutsch.
André Deutsch, yes.
I think they all came from Vienna.
I didn't know that, Hazel. That's so interesting. Yes.
Paul Hamlin, I think, was from Prague, wasn't
Well, and Pevsner.
Yes, that's right. And, I mean, before that, publishing was rather sort of Tweedy and English-focused, but they kind of opened it up to the world. And Weidenfeld published many, many biographies, didn't he, of European leaders and so on. But, you know, they were sort of like an enormous breath of fresh air.
Yes. Lacour, who became the director, Walter Lacour, who became director of the library after Wiener, he was published by Weidenfeld. He got out just before or after the November pogrom in 1938. His parents were murdered. Yes, I mean, it was an extraordinary group of people.
Yes.
So, Tony, the original library actually moved to Israel, to Tel Aviv, didn't it, in 1980?
It did, yes, it did. And I went back to the library after a very short break of a year or so to run one of the biggest microfilm projects of its day, microfilm in those days being how you preserved stuff and made copies. The fact that the original library was going to Tel Aviv seemed quite belatedly to wake up the Jewish communities of both this country and the exiled German Jewish community. And they began to raise money for a London branch of the library. And from the early 1980s, it was built up again. There was a big exhibition, 50 years since he'd founded the original Wiener Library. And then funds began to come in. And so the London Wiener Library had a very successful renaissance. It's been given a lot of donations. And latterly, it's become a repository for a lot of Jewish families of emigres and refugees who have family documents of various kinds and they're looking for a safe home for them. They've got 2,000 family documents. Mm.
Tony, thank you so much. I've learned an enormous amount about something I knew very little about. Thank you.
Thank you for asking.
Will you stay put with us, Tony, and give us a book recommendation?
Yes, yes, I will. Yeah.
So before we move on, just a brief word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Now, as we mentioned earlier, Steph has another Slightly Foxed day out for us, for book lovers. Steph, tell us again, where have you been?
We have been to Petersfield on the Hampshire-West Sussex border. I live about 5 miles away in the South Downs. Hattie, from the office, her parents live in Petersfield.
Okay.
And Gail grew up a short way away and spent many of her weekends and much of her pocket money in the Petersfield bookshop.
Aha.
And that's not my dog, that's Gail's dog.
I'm sorry. That's Stanley.
I was going to say, let's just leave that on the tape because we're all familiar with Slightly Foxed dogs.
My husband's gone to see to them.
Well, Petersfield has 3 bookshops. It has One Tree Books, a new modern bookshop that has actually been going for 27 years. It's a large, bright, airy shop with a wonderful cafe at the back. We've had several Slightly Foxed events there. We've had launches of our editions, and they have cookery evenings there as well. They're very much part of the community. They act as box office for the local schools if they have theatre productions, and they also sell tickets for local literary festivals. And we've been involved in the Westmeon Festival and the Readers Group Festival, which is run by one of our subscribers, Ela Huxford.
And they're also very knowledgeable, aren't they, Steph? I mean, I've been in there and asked for some fairly obscure things and, you know, nothing is too much trouble.
Yeah, they're a really great team. There is also a Waterstones in Petersfield. And then down the road, there is the legendary Petersfield Bookshop, which is an antiquarian and secondhand shop that has been going for over 100 years. That is a real must visit. It's a maze of bookshelves, floor to ceiling. It was set up in 1918 by an East End doctor, Harry Roberts, and then taken over in 1958 by Frank Westwood, who moved the business to Chapel Street in Petersfield. He then expanded into various shops and other buildings around. So it really is a warren of rooms. The family are still involved in the shop. His wife was a doll collector, so there is a cabinet of dolls there. There's ephemera all over the shop. There are old typewriters, a Doctor Who phone box. There's a Rocky Horror butler.
It sounds fabulous.
It's a real treasure trove. It really is. And when we have a little sort of Slightly Fox meeting down here, we go to that bookshop and have a good wander around. Mm. My favourite display is the things that fell out of books. You know, if you buy a secondhand book, often something comes out of it. So there are old postcards, love letters, shopping lists, train tickets. It's fantastic.
That is such a charming idea. Yeah. One of the great things about buying secondhand books is that there is often something tucked away in them.
Yeah, and the stories from that. And there is a very good story attached to the Petersfield Bookshop as well. Last January, Robert Sampson, who manages the shop, was having a very bad day. Cold, nobody had been in, and he tweeted that for the first day in possibly 100 years, they hadn't made a sale. Few people retweeted this tweet, and then Neil Gaiman, the author, retweeted it to his 2.8 million followers. Okay. It went round the world. And the following morning, they had £1,000 worth of orders, 300 emails. They were on the radio, they made BBC News at 10.
Actually, I remember hearing this now. I hadn't realised it was that bookshop. That is so brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so heartwarming.
Yes, they're very heartwarming, aren't they? I like the fact that they have a sort of a display outside in the forecourt for desperate book lovers who can't get in when they're closed with an honesty box.
Do they?
They have the little canopied forecourt.
So if you need a fix, you can get...
if you're an insomniac book lover.
But it's a very dangerous place to go. I really did spend all my pocket money. I used to go round right at the very back. There's a room which is fiction and quite a lot of military history. And I would spend hours crouched down in the corner going through the shelves and invariably come out with at least a couple of bags worth of books.
Is that why you became a historian, do you think, Gail?
I think it's probably why I became a publisher.
Yeah.
And why, the obsession with books, basically. But my parents used to despair of me because I had an allowance which was supposed to be spent on clothes. And of course, it all went on books. So whenever we went anywhere, I never had the right clothes.
I was just the same.
I mean, it's a pretty good habit to have, really.
I think so.
Embarrassing, nonetheless.
Thank you, Steph. I think that takes us very neatly onto book recommendations from everyone. So will you kick us off, Steph?
Yes, my recommendation is an Eland book called Dinner of Herbs, Village Life in Turkey in the 1960s by Carla Grissman.
Steph, I'm going to stop you there. What is that noise that I can hear behind you?
I think that's the combine going past.
A combine harvester?
Or it's a very, very large tractor. I'm surrounded by fields here.
I was going to say it can't be a combine harvester, Steph. Even I, as a Londoner, know. You know, this is not the time of year for combine harvesters. Now we've delved into that, so I do apologise. Carry on. Well,
Carla was an American by birth. She lived around the world. She lived in Morocco, Tunisia. At the time this book is set, she'd been working in Jerusalem. She was proofreading in an English department of a newspaper. And she was intrigued by the cave churches in rural Turkey. She went to Turkey. She knew that there were villages in Anatolia that were never visited by foreigners, and she persuaded a friend to take her there, and she ended up living in Uzak Koy for a year in the late 1960s. And it's just a beautiful book. Life there is so simple. They prayed, fasted, feasted. She wanted to specifically live in a Muslim village.
Right.
And it's a very, very simple book, maybe sort of ideal for this time in our lives. And very, very lovely. I can really recommend it. And the title comes from Proverbs 15, verse 17. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than feasting on a fattened ox where hatred also dwells.
Thank you. Tony, what have you got for us?
I've been rereading a book, actually, which I first read in the 70s, which is not from Nazi Germany, but from the Soviet Union. The title in English is Hope Against Hope, and the author was Nadezhda Mandelstam. She was the widow of a Russian poet who died in the Gulag in 38. His wife didn't write anything or didn't publish anything until she started writing in the 60s when there was a bit of a thaw, and it finally saw the light of day in the early 1970s. It's an absolutely outstanding insight into what it's like to live through a totalitarian epoch. Mandelstam was picked up as part of what became known as the Great Terror. And the extraordinary thing about the book is the directness with which the author writes, the immediacy of what the book really concentrates on, the 4 years she was in exile with him. And it's not irrelevant today, I don't think. The Soviet Union is sort of dead and gone. But people have been bandying the word totalitarian around during our lockdowns.
Indeed.
Well, anyone who wants to really know what totalitarianism is like, told in the most gripping form, I would recommend Hope Against Hope.
Thank you. Hazel.
Thinking about this podcast, I went to my shelf and found a book that I bought a long time ago. It's called Defying Hitler. It's written by someone called Sebastian Hafner. In fact, that wasn't his birth name. He grew up as Roland Pretzel in Berlin. In fact, it's an unfinished book. It was first published in 2000 in German, and then it was translated and published in this country. And Sebastian Hafner was, I think, 7 when the First World War broke out. He was a historian who also became a very successful journalist. And his son says in the introduction that he thought his father wrote this book to answer the question asked by his generation of Germans, how were the Nazis possible and why didn't you stop them?
Yes.
And it's really an attempt to describe in detail. He wrote the book in, I think, 1938, when he had actually left Germany for this country. And he didn't finish it, because he turned to other, what he thought were in a way more serious historical writing. But it's an attempt to sort of chronicle the horrible and kind of subtle way in which the Nazi regime took over, how on the surface so often life seemed almost normal, but at a sort of deeper level it was being gradually undermined. He was a lawyer and he was working in the central law courts in Berlin. And he describes how very gradually laws were brought in, how the older people who were sort of upholding the constitution gradually sidelined and younger Nazi sympathisers were brought in. He tried to leave. He couldn't cope anymore. And he went to Paris in 1934, but wasn't really able to make a living there and came back, but finally did leave for England in 1938. By this time, he'd met the person he married and was pregnant with their son, who's translated the book. And he was actually helped by Fred Warburg, who encouraged him to write this book. He arrived in England on the pretext of doing some articles, but the government wouldn't allow him to stay, even though he married his wife, who was already in England. He became a very sort of well-known and successful journalist. The book was published in Germany in 2000, and it was a sort of enormous bestseller. But it's just a very fascinating and chilling account of what it was like to be a German who was opposed to the Nazi regime, and how gradually all your liberties were undermined and taken away. I found it very fascinating as a kind of an insight into that time for somebody who didn't really know a great deal about it.
Thank you. Gail.
I'm going to recommend a historical novel based on fact called An Officer and a Spy by Robert Harris. It's published in 2013. And it's a fictionalised account of the Dreyfus Affair.
Ah.
So Alfred Dreyfus was in the French army. He was Jewish. He was from Strasbourg. And in 1895, he was tried for espionage and sentenced to lifetime solitary confinement. Before he was taken off to Devil's Island, he was paraded in Paris in front of the army. His sword was broken, his epaulettes were ripped off. And this was, in the novel, was witnessed by a fellow army officer called Georges Picard, who had arranged the degradation and as a result was promoted and put in charge of the statistical section, which is a shadowy intelligence unit within the army. So Dreyfus is shipped off to Devil's Island and spends the next 4 years in the most horrendous conditions, unable to talk to anybody, unable to see anybody, in dreadful tropical heat, shackled a lot of the time, just awful. And Georges Picot, as he takes over the bureau, he begins to question the evidence. And basically it's the story of how he uncovers this appalling miscarriage of justice, which has been fueled by corruption in the name of national security, terrible anti-Semitism, a witch hunt by the press. And in the end, Picot himself becomes almost as much in danger as Dreyfus was. He's turned on. But eventually, justice does triumph. Émile Zola famously wrote that article called J'accuse. And in fact, the copy of the book I've got has got a reproduction of that article as a gate leaf in the M papers. But it is an extraordinary account of anti-Semitism and its consequences. And obviously, this pre-shadows what happened in Germany. Horrendous attitudes and atmosphere of hatred and loathing. Turns out, of course, it was not Dreyfus who was the spy, but the army fights any attempt to pardon Dreyfus, you know, with tooth and nail. It is the most gripping story and a wonderful reimagining by Robert Harris, and I do recommend it.
That's a great recommendation. I've been aware of that book, but I haven't ever actually read it.
It's gripping. Yeah. It really is. And you feel such a sense of burning injustice. I mean, you know, you almost want to shout at the page as you're reading it. Sorry, not
Thank
a very
you.
Cheerful note to end on.
Well... Thank you, Gail. Thank you, everyone. Tony, many thanks again for being with us. It's just been fascinating hearing about the Vienna Library. Thank you very much.
Well, it's very kind of you to ask me. Thank you.
We will be back in February. In the meantime, if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, please do rate us. And if you have a moment, you could write us a review. A lot of kind listeners all over the world have already done that. We're very appreciative. That is it for this month. So here's to a crisp and cold rest of January, rather than the dreek days that we usually endure in the UK at this time of year. As always, thank you for listening and for joining us on our first 2021 literary expedition off the beaten track.